Hey everyone, welcome to a special Your Amigos Community Oncology podcast.
We're they're all special, Brian. They're all special.
They're all special, yes. Yeah. This one is especially special.
Okay.
Thank you for interrupting me 9 seconds in. It's Mike Latanzi is with us, and we're going to talk about, I don't know, a bunch of things. Some of the issues around being a community oncologist, staying on top of data in a busy practice, you know, what sort of take-home messages. We're going to talk through that. And then at the end, this is motivation to stay till the end, we're going to give sort of the 60-second summary of management of advanced kidney, bladder, and prostate cancer, sort of the take-home point. So, Mike, welcome. If you want to go ahead and introduce yourself, and then maybe kick off with, I don't know, your background a little bit, how you got into community oncology, and then what is it like day-to-day?
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you guys for having me. Good to be with you. So Mike Latanzi, I'm a GU medical oncologist by training. I did all my medical training in New York City. I think we probably know some similar folks. I worked pretty closely with Arjun Bhalar when he was at NYU, where I did my residency, and then worked with the GU group and Jonathan Rosenberg and the rest of the team at MSK for fellowship.
And I had half a pint of lager with Arjun at ASCO GU. He was in fine form.
Thanks, yes. Tom. That's pretty critical information. Thanks for interrupting.
That was a very informative interruption for those of you listening. You can expect equally high quality from me for the rest of the podcast.
Go ahead, Mike.
And then, you know, after fellowship, was kind of looking for a community-based practice where I'd be able to still do clinical research, and started looking around, and ultimately, you know, entertained some academic groups, but ultimately landed with Texas Oncology. We're the largest community-based cancer provider in the country. We have over 500 doctors kind of scattered throughout across the state of Texas, both in, you know, large cities as well as small towns and, you know, Marble Falls, Beaumont, Texas. So places you may have never even heard of, but we have a clinic in those places, and we provide care to majority of patients in the state of Texas. Now, I'm a GU medical oncologist by training, and as you know, you can imagine, I have a great deal of exposure to GU cancers, in particular urothelial cancer, as well as RCC and prostate. And then, you know, a general training in, you know, bread and butter hematology, oncology as well. And, you know, as part of a busy community-based practice, you know, see the full spectrum of solid tumors, as well as kind of the full spectrum of benign and even malignant hematology.
So how much of your practice is GU and how much is other? And is it typical in a community oncology setting to see, I kind of thought people would see, oh, GU and GI, and then somebody else might see breast and lung, but it sounds like you're kind of seeing anything that walks in the door.
Yeah, you know, one of the benefits of community oncology is that it's really an independent physician practice. You know, my partners and I all run or essentially own practices. And so we're somewhat free to kind of shape the practice, you know, how we'd like. You know, but on the downside, there's somewhat, you know, less collective action, you know, whereas if you were with a big academic group, they would say, oh, yeah, Mike, you see the bladder cancer and I'll see the RCC. And that sort of thing, you know, doesn't, you know, happen so much, at least in our practice, particularly not in the smaller cities where that kind of specialization is impossible. So, or impractical. So what, you know, what ends up happening is, you know, folks kind of build an area of focus and try to build a referral base. So I make it a point to try to get to know most of the local urologists and, you know, attend most of the local tumor boards in the GU space and try and kind of build out a GU practice where I'm sort of focusing primarily on GU malignancies, but also, of course, you know, one of the value propositions of community oncology is we're accessible to the patients. And that means seeing a patient same day in some cases, no matter what their diagnosis, and just getting patients in the door and getting them access to, you know, high value care. And to that end, you know, I'll certainly see patients, you know, either in the hospital or in the clinic with, you know, any range of hematologic or oncologic problems. And so I'm still kind of building my practice. You know, right now I'd say GU is kind of the majority of my solid tumor practice, probably around 55-60% of my solid tumor practice. And then, you know, about half my practice is devoted to, you know, other diseases, you know, DVT, PE, leukemia, lymphoma, thoracic, breast, et cetera.
Mike, how does multidisciplinary care work? Does it work?
Yeah.
If so, how?
I think, you know, in the community, we all rely pretty heavily on our kind of individual network of friends and colleagues around town. And that's kind of one of the unique aspects of, you know, community practice. I can't necessarily send somebody down the hall to see endocrinology when I think they have adrenal insufficiency. I can't send somebody down the hall to see dermatology when I think they've got a bad EV rash. So realistically, you know, what happens in the community is the medical oncologists end up preliminarily managing a lot of these, you know, treatment-related, you know, toxicities associated with, you know, novel therapies. And then certainly, you know, have our own individual Rolodexes of, you know, oh, that guy in derm is good, or oh, that urologist is really good. And everybody kind of builds out their own kind of small network of providers that we each individually rely on. But, you know, to your point, multidisciplinary care is, you know, extremely challenging in the community. Patients are often going to one office, you know, across town for their TURBT. They're coming to a different office potentially for chemotherapy. They're going to a different office potentially for radiation.
So if you wanted to give someone adjuvant Pembro, you know, and how do those patients who are at risk within that group get access to adjuvant Pembro?
So that's an interesting subject in and of itself. I mean, you know, so my practice pattern, you know, particularly in light of the data presented at GU ASCO, is to offer it to, you know, almost all the eligible patients, high risk patients. You know, interesting. And so I really rely on the urologist kind of making that determination and then kind of referring patients for appropriate adjuvant therapy. One kind of interesting difference about community oncology specific to GU that I think a lot of folks in big academic centers don't necessarily realize, and I think a lot of folks in the industry don't realize, is that in the community, it's actually urologists who are often managing advanced GU cancers in some cases. That's particularly the case in hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. And increasingly, it's, you know, it's the case across other GU malignancies as well. And I know a lot of the big urology groups are, in fact, giving adjuvant pembrolizumab themselves, either a urologist being the one kind of prescribing it and managing it with close medical oncology backup, or a lot of the urology groups bring in their own medical oncologist to kind of
To put you on the spot, how do you feel about that?
I mean, that's obviously an area of consternation, I think, for both parties. I think, you know, realistically, you know, I try to add value to patients and to the referring providers. You know, as a medical oncologist, I trained in the era of immunotherapy and kind of well-versed in the management of toxicities and in kind of the management of patients with advanced cancer or high-risk localized cancers in general. And certainly would encourage, you know, any patient who to kind of seek out, you know, an opinion from a medical oncologist for management of an advanced cancer. And I think so, the urologists, some of their expert surgeons, but didn't necessarily train in the management of systemic therapies. And so I think a lot of times, you know, if patients develop toxicity, they often, you know, have to refer over to medical oncology to manage the more complex issues.
Our friends in Germany, of course, do the same, and in Japan. And so it's not a unique approach. Whether it's the right approach or wrong approach is complicated. Moving from different healthcare environment to the next is obviously challenging on the one hand for patients. But you're right, we get the impression that as things get more complicated, I certainly don't feel confident in doing a cystectomy as it currently stands. But then you might say I'm not trained to do that. And also, even if I was, you probably wouldn't want me to do it. Mike, I guess my question is possession then 9/10 of the law? In that if the patients are in front of you and you're treating them and you've got a good rapport with them, essentially, they'll probably, my experience is patients tend to stick with doctors who are kind to them, who they trust, and are delivering an efficient service. Is that essentially what's happening in the community quite a lot?
Oh, 100%. I mean, that's the entire kind of value of community care is we're, you know, one, we're probably close to your home. And two, you know, as a medical oncologist, I can spend a fair amount of time with patients and kind of talk through the logistics of, you know, advanced disease, advanced care planning, goals of care discussions, you know, systemic treatment options, and the kind of the vast array of, you know, toxicities patients might encounter. And I tend to think that the patients, you know, kind of appreciate the extra time and the extra consultation. Frankly, just appreciate the discussion. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what is your clinic load, if you don't mind me asking, on a daily or weekly basis? Because yeah. I hear a lot in conferences where people say, oh, I have this nuanced benefit risk discussion with the patient and da-da-da, and I'm thinking to myself.
I actually suggested that question as the pre-run. Very rarely we have pre-runs to meetings. We choose to do it here. And Brian, you said that was a terrible question.
No, I didn't say it was a terrible question. Most of your questions are terrible. That one was.
I feel there's been a.
I just didn't want to spend a lot of time on the operations.
I feel there's been a theft, Mike. There's been a theft in this podcast.
No, I'm saying. You know, I hear people say, well, you involve the patient, it's patient-driven, right. It's shared decision-making, and I'm thinking to myself, boy, how many patients do you see in a day? Because it'd be challenging to get through a day with, you know, if each patient's taking 45 minutes.
Correct, yeah. I mean, and so that's, you know, another, you know, there's a lot of heterogeneity out there, I would say, you know, from practice to practice. Texas oncology, very different than our counterparts in Nashville or counterparts in Virginia or Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm building a practice essentially from the ground up. So I showed up on my first day at work and had literally zero patients. And it was kind of incumbent on me to kind of go out and build relationships with local urologists, spend time at the hospital, seeing consults and sort of building up a practice that way. And so, you know, at this point, I'm about a year and a half in, I see anywhere from 10 to 25 patients a day. And I try to focus that as much as possible on GU, kind of mindful that the extra bandwidth that it takes to get into the nitty-gritty of, say, lymphoma or the nitty-gritty of lung cancer is going to kind of detract from being able to have that nuanced conversation that you point out is so important.
Mike, if you wanted to broadcast, let's say we had a positive trial, let's say belzutifan, you know, let's say that it's just recently FDA approved. How does the community keep up with the data? What do they look at and what do they listen to? And what's the most efficient way of broadcasting to them?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of us rely on, you know, podcasts, whether it be Your Amigos.
That's the right answer.
Excellent. 10 out of 10. You're coming to the ASCO party, that's for sure.
For sure.
But, you know, certainly there's other podcasts for other diseases as well, and other kind of general, you know, community oncology podcasts that are very good. And I think the shorter form, the better. I think, you know, for busy clinicians, and by the way, I see patients 5 days a week. I'm actually taking an hour out of clinic right now to talk with you guys. So time is very precious. And I think a lot of us rely on kind of short form educational things like podcasts. And we also rely on, you know, local CME events. I know our group usually, the docs will come out for local CME events. So we usually try to do those through one of the CME vendors, you know, at least once a month, you know, updates in GI from GI ASCO, GU updates from GU ASCO, et cetera.
And when you say short form, you know, and we're this part of the motivation to do our minute summary at the end was from this. I mean, you know, Tom and I get into the weeds and Tom talks about PD-L1 and ctDNA and it's, you know, way down into the weeds of hazard ratio. But you're telling me
some would say boring, Brian. Some might say boring.
I was about to get there. Some would say that's not super
useful. That's very sweet,
Mike. Right. It's not maybe super useful because if you're seeing 10 different cancers a day, that's it's just too much. Like there's only so much nuance you can keep track of. Is that correct? Like what's the best form? You know, if Tom and I wanted to do a community oncology podcast series, you know, what does short form mean? Is it literally like 10 minutes? Is it a half hour? What does that look like?
Oh, yeah. I mean, 10, certainly less than 10 minutes, I think, realistically. I think people really just want to know what drug they should be using in which setting and what are the marquee toxicities. I mean, and that's just a question of bandwidth more than anything else.
Got it. And now that's I always wanted to ask about research. You know, research in a community oncology setting, obviously big groups like Texas Onc, you know, Sarah Cannon here in town do a lot of research. How hard is that? How different is it? How do you enable that in a community practice?
So, you know, the practice as a whole, you know, research is a major priority for the practice. You know, the challenge in accruing patients to trials is one, convincing industry sponsored to open up, you know, the myriad sites that we have throughout the state when they're already going to open at UT Southwestern, they're already going to open at Anderson, and they want some geographic diversity, and kind of convincing sponsors that we need more sites. But I think the research infrastructure is actually quite good because it's a priority of the practice. And, you know, I have some experience, you know, coming from an academic center, and I can tell you that the research infrastructure is actually quite good and high fidelity. And we have a sort of a dedicated team of sort of the most skilled nurses who kind of head up our research program. And we're able to do trials, you know, mostly phase two, phase three, increasingly, though, you know, first in human phase one studies as well. And I think go ahead.
How many trials will you have open and how many patients do you accrue a year?
Yeah, so me personally, you know, it's still kind of evolving because I'm new to the group, but I would say the typical investigator, you know, in a Texas oncology practice will enroll maybe 10 to 20 patients per year on trial. And I think, you know, that's probably, you know, for the folks who are kind of interested and engaged in research, you know, one of the challenges we face in the community is we'll open up trials, you know, across our sites. But it's not necessarily the case that every sub-investigator at every one of those sites is necessarily keen on putting patients on protocol. So a lot of the heavy lifting is really kind of convincing some of the other docs to, hey, before you, you know, go through your algorithm and put the patient on the next line of systemic therapy, hey, think about, you know, what trials we might have available in that space.
Mike, I'm acutely cognizant that we've gone over the 10 minutes. So we've lost... we probably have. Is this the moment where we should do the 1 minute on each cancer?
Let's do it. Yeah.
Should we do it in reverse GU ASCO order?
Kidney first, bladder second. You want to do renal first?
Yeah. I think so. Okay. Well, I think we should call it from now on the reverse GU ASCO order.
Fine.
In the hope that we can put enough pressure on the committee to do renal cancer.
I'm sure they're listening. I'm sure they're listening.
Well, you know, if they are, why not try something new? Why not?
60 seconds for all of renal cancer.
Go on then.
Okay. So for localized renal cancer, basically cut it out in high-risk disease, basically T2 high-grade and above, adjuvant pembrolizumab as a standard of care with DFS and now OS benefit, although clouded a bit by other negative trials. In the advanced setting, there's a subset of indolent patients that can be observed or have local approaches like metastasectomy or SBRT to oligometastatic disease. But most patients initially or eventually will need systemic therapy, and standard of care is a immune-based doublet with a PD-1 backbone with either adding ipilimumab, i.e. ipi-nivo, or one of three TKIs, axi, lenva, or cabo, in various combinations that have all been shown to extend survival. The kidney cancer nerds argue all the time about which one is best, but they're all good and they all have advantages and disadvantages. In the refractory space, it's basically TKI as a very unsatisfactory standard of care. Now belzutifan in the third and fourth line setting, but probably moving up. And then you have things like mTOR inhibition and lenvatinib, but basically a myriad of targeted therapies. And again, we can argue one's better than the other, but they're all basically non-curative.
Nephrectomy and metastatic disease?
Well, that's a complicated topic. It's not in the minute. I think nephrectomy can be considered upfront in select patients.
Don't do it. And if in doubt, don't do it. If in doubt,
I don't know about that. I think debulking nephrectomy can be considered in select upfront patients and select patients after systemic therapy, but that's a complicated topic.
Fabulous. Bron, I've got to say, it was majestic. Majestic. Mike, do you think?
I agree. Perfect 60-second blurb on RCC.
I tried to interrupt at one point, and I was ignored. Okay, here we go. We're going to remove the bladder cancer. Are we good to go?
Let's go. I'm timing it. Ready,
are you timing it? Go.
Yeah.
Okay. Cystectomy for T2 to T4A disease. Neoadjuvant cisplatin-based chemotherapy, a 5 to 13% survival advantage. Controversy around adjuvant immune checkpoint inhibition, but a disease-free survival advantage and FDA approval for nivolumab. First-line metastatic disease, EV and pembro for everyone who can have it, which is the vast majority of patients,
and there aren't that many alternatives. It's hard to find now a GemCis or a GemCarbo patient. There are other approaches historically with maintenance of avelumab and the addition of Nevo, but the data's not as attractive as EV Pembro. Treatment after EV Pembro should probably be platinum-based chemotherapy, but the evidence for that is weak. Patients with FGFR alterations should have erdafitinib, and other drugs like sacituzumab govitecan have relatively limited data at the moment, and we're awaiting randomized trials, but clearly have activity in this disease.
Tom, that's why can't you be that concise all the time?
Oh, I'd like to. I like to have real answers.
110 seconds. That was beautiful. I have a tear running down my cheek right now.
Well, that's sweet of you, Brian. I think this has been a good bonding session for us.
It's been a good bonding session. Brian, you did offer to
take on prostate cancer.
I'm going to try prostate cancer, but it's you know, less than my wheelhouse. So I'm going to just do advanced disease. I'm not going to talk about rising
cancer. Yes, of course.
All right. Metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer, standard of care is androgen suppression, i.e. LHRH agonists or antagonists, plus an antiandrogen. Pick your favorite. There's a subpopulation of probably synchronous high-volume disease that can also get chemotherapy. I think that's relatively infrequently used in practice, but there's good data to support it. And then it's not dissimilar from bladder cancer, where we have then a number of other approaches to consider. PARP inhibitors for patients with HRR mutations, specifically BRCA, and a lot of controversy around which one to use and the benefit and how to select patients in non-BRCA HRR mutations, but definitely a role in genetic testing should be done early in the course of the disease. We have radiopharmaceuticals, lutetium, with initial data after chemotherapy, now before chemotherapy, for PSMA PET positive patients, which will be the majority of patients. You have second antiandrogen, so-called androgen switch, which has some activity but has controversy as the control arm of trials, but in practice, I think is a very easy and practical thing to try in a subset of perhaps more indolent patients. And then, of course, chemotherapy, if they didn't get it up front, namely Taxotere, but also cabazitaxel, that most patients aren't keen on, and I tend to sort of give it late in the course of the disease. What have I missed?
Did you hit the lutetium?
I did. Did you fall asleep during that minute?
No, I just wondered if you wanted to talk about the biomarker.
We kept it to a minute for attention span purposes.
I wondered if you wanted to talk about the biomarker associated with that. But
I did, for PSMA PET positive.
Okay, patients. I'm sorry. Apologies. Yep. Brian, I thought fabulous. I've got to say, fabulous again. Very strong.
Maybe Mike, our podcast could just be 3 minutes total.
Well, I think we
save
found
us
something.
A lot of time.
We've struck on something new here, which I think is exciting. We can certainly show. We've demonstrated we can do it in 10 minutes. The question is, do we choose to do that, Brian? Or I mean, we've got Hans Hammers coming on the show soon. I promise that won't be 10 minutes.
Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, that's not going to be 10 minutes. Look, Mike, anything you'd like to say before we call it?
Just that, you know, I guess the one thing I would...
About half of the patients,
half the cancer patients in the United States are treated in community settings. And if we restrict trials, you know, to predominantly the academic centers, we're going to kind of misrepresent the true patient population. And I'm joining kind of Texas Oncology at an exciting time where we're partnering with Sarah Cannon and also growing our own research program to expand access to clinical trials for patients in the community, and would encourage, you know, any patients who might be listening to kind of seek out clinical trials.
Yeah, no, we agree. And I mean, Sarah Cannon's my competitor down the street, but I totally agree. In fact, I think there's things that you can do research-wise in your settings that we as big academic centers probably struggle with. So I think it's complementary, right? And I agree that, you know, we're all for more accrual on clinical trials across the spectrum of whoever's doing the treating.
Agreed.
Mike, thanks for your time today. Have a terrific weekend.
Thank you, guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks for taking the time, Mike. Take care. Bye-bye.